This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we've got one sponsor for the show, that's Jam Software, and we'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, how's your week been?
It's been good. Finishing up our re-enrollment period for the... It's, I guess, technically considered sort of like, not early re-enrollment, but normal re-enrollments, like the re-enrollment fee goes up after this Friday. So mm-hmm. just been, since it's the first year of a new system, it's just been lots of phone calls and lots of emails. So it's been a busy week. So many of you know from the last show, I was supposed to attend an Apple event to look at iOS 9.3. Was not able to go, but I had a good reason. Sunday, my oldest son had a visit to the ER very late. He's fine. Cool. But so that was fun. And then approximately 3 hours later, my wife threw up for like 8 hours and was in the bed all day Monday. So I was at home. And so it was... Being this re-enrollment time, it was like tough to be out of the office 2 days in a row, and because that was like a 2 hour, car trip each way. So so I had to skip it, which stinks, but that's life.
You know, when I was younger, I used to wonder, like, who are these people who don't show up for flights, and who are these people who don't do their taxes on time, and who are these people that just cancel events? And now I realize that I'm at the stage of life where I'm all of those people now.
Yeah, there are people that have children that they always. The thing about children, for good or bad, they have a way of needing you at inconvenient times.
Yeah, yeah, they do. But they're worth it.
Yes.
Most of them.
Yes. So
most of the time.
Before we get into the actual notes for tonight, what's been going on?
Yeah, it's been a good week for iOS apps, I think. There was a big update to the Ulysses app, which is a kind of markdown... A large-scale markdown editor, if you like. It's a little bigger than, say, an app like OneWriter or Editorial, which are just their text file editors that connect with Dropbox and whatever. But Markdown is, Ulysses is designed to be a kind of writer's app, if you like, so you can break your writing into what they call sheets, which are essentially individual blocks of text, and then you can export multiple of these at once into a nice PDF format or an HTML format and so on. And it just got a major update for, it came out on the iPhone, went universal for iPhone. It was an iPad app before, and it got iPad Pro support as well. So I picked that up. I hadn't had it before, and I was hoping that it would be a useful way to write for iTunes U, which I do a lot, obviously, because we run a lot of our classes through iTunes U in school. And up till now, I had been writing in Omni Outliner, which had been okay, but Omni Outliner is a little bit weird when it comes to like exporting the document into a plain text version. It likes to try and preserve its outline structure by indenting with spaces and tabs and so on, which leads to a lot of kind of rework when all you want out is all those rows as plain lines, if you like. So what I was hoping was that I could still kind of write the outlines for the lessons and maybe the summaries in Omni Outliner, because I really like the Outliner way of working for that kind of thinking, but then actually write the content inside Ulysses. And I failed the bug with Apple as well, so they'll hopefully support Markdown editing inside iTunes U as well. So that would be really nice if you could write in Markdown in an app like Ulysses or OneWriter or Editorial, and then just copy and paste straight into, or even share straight into iTunes U as a post. That's kind of my dream next step for iTunes U. Hoping this happens.
Well, and it's really not that far of a step. Because I believe, doesn't Swift support Markdown?
I believe it does. I mean, I don't know of any Apple application that, apart from Xcode, that supports Markdown as an input format. But you could see how that would happen. I mean, I think there, in if you use iTunes U on the desktop, you can, like through the browser, you can. I seem to remember you could do something with like importing a Word file or something like that. Maybe that was just for the course outline. I know in iBooks Author, for example, you can drag and drop a Word file right into iBooks Author and it will try and parse out all the formatting it can. So I would like to see some new things happen there. I think that could be quite cool.
Hey, can we just have a real complaint session about iBooks Author? What a dumpster fire that is in 2016.
Well, it kind of started and went nowhere, you know. I keep referring to getting the iTunes radio treatment. But I think... It depends why you think that iBooks Author exists, right? One school of thought is that iBooks Author exists so that teachers can make really high-quality learning materials and give it to their students and all that stuff. The other side is it was given out free as a tool to persuade publishers to create textbooks for the iPad. And therefore, if you have textbooks for the iPad, and you remember the iBooks Author came out just when Apple opened the textbook section of the bookstore and also imposed an upper limit on the cost of the textbook, I strongly feel that what Apple was trying to do, at least in the US, was have the iPad replace the very, very expensive American textbooks. And that would actually justify for many schools the cost of going iPad would just be to get to $17.99 textbooks. That economic model doesn't make sense in the rest of the world. And in fact, for many countries in the world, that was a price increase for textbooks. I suppose it depends who you think iBooks Author's for. If you think it's for use in the classroom, it totally should be on iOS. But if you think it's a tool for publishers to make cheap textbooks so that people will buy iPads, then I guess it makes sense the way it was.
Well, you know, the real issue with that, even in the US, is it was more expensive. Well, for a lot of schools, because if you're the type of school that the students have to buy their own books, no problem at all, then it is cheaper.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
a lot of schools actually buy the books and then basically let the students just use them. And then they don't, you know, obviously
keep them for years and years.
Yeah, we keep the same books for like 4 to 5 years, easy. Mm-hmm. And so with there was no way iBooks, the volume purchase program with iBooks never got the ability to revoke a license treatment. And I imagine that's obviously a publisher thing.
Yeah.
So you just kind of start running the numbers, and it's like way more expensive to distribute iBooks.
Yeah.
Now, and I think you've said this many times, the, you know, kind of like the early on, like you said, we talked about, like, you know, this thing, oh, they can replace textbooks, they can get rid of their backpacks, and it can save everybody a bunch of money, and that's why you should buy an iPad. But our school of thought there has largely changed over the years, to where, as you said, if you're locking up the iPad as just a textbook device, and it's really limiting the potential of it, you might as well just get a Kindle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the Kindle DX is exactly what that was going to be. But I think one of the things about if you ask people in the schools and in the education system, what do you think tablets are for in schools? Teachers and students have very varied responses to that answer. But school administrators and parents have basically one answer for that question, which is textbooks, at least in the US. It seems to be that the surveys that I see from the US are primarily those people in senior management and parents, people who are a little bit removed from the classroom action, to be quite honest with you. They often say textbooks. And of course, who pays for iPad deployments in schools? School administrators and parents. So I think there's a lot of... I think there was a story to be told there to those constituencies about textbooks and iPad. But I don't know that teachers are that interested in it. I don't think students are that interested in it either, to be quite honest with you. I think it is much more a story for management rather than a story for the actual users.
Yeah, it's just funny how things have changed over the years.
Yeah, I mean, from the two things that came out of that 2012 education event, the iBooks Author and iTunes U, with the course manager and everything, iTunes U for me is the one that has been the stellar hit. And quite frankly, you can see the amount of investment and effort Apple's put into iTunes U in the intervening time versus the amount of effort that's gone into iBooks Author in the intervening time. And it's clear from what I see from teachers. Next Saturday, I'm going to a conference where I will present some of our kind of more esoteric uses of iTunes U. And I don't know that anybody there is going to be mentioning iBooks Author, seriously. I just don't think it's not a major player in the classroom space, not in the way that iTunes U is.
Yeah, it may be the fact that Apple's thinking of what the iPad is supposed to do in the classroom has changed, and therefore... Mm-hmm. But in reality, should they not just kill iBooks Author?
Well, I mean, the problem with killing something that has its own file format is you're really screwing over people who invested in it. And in some ways, it's probably better to keep it going and keep it around so that people don't feel like Apple burned them than to kill it off, even if it may cost you a little bit. I mean, I don't know how much actual work is happening on iBooks Author at all. I mean, it got a 2.0 and then nothing really since, I don't know. So unless it's going to come to iOS, I mean, that's the thing that to me would kind of revive the fortunes of iBooks Author, because there are EPUB editors like Book Creator on iOS, and why iBooks Author is not native on, at least on the iPad Pro, I don't know. I mean, effort, time, probably, but it seems to me that building those books in their native place would seem to make some kind of sense to me.
Yeah. Anyways, that was a rat hole, but
Hey, I mean, it's a question that people ask, right? iTunes, you're iBooks author, and what our teachers have always said to me is that iBooks author feels like too much of an undertaking, you know, to write a book, basically. And I try to encourage people to use iBooks author for smaller things, but nobody really liked that compared to the simplicity and ease of use. I mean, iTunes U is like using email. It's so easy, so quick, so fluid, versus iBooks author, which is like handwriting a letter by comparison.
Before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for tonight. It's the great folks at Jamp Software. Jamp Software provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in schools. This includes Macs, iPhones, iPads, and even Apple TVs. They have a great app for teachers that runs on their iPad called Castor Focus that allows them to select a specific Apple TV, conduct secure exams within an app, distribute iBooks, and initiate AirPlay right from within Castor Focus. Learn more about Castor Focus, the Castor Suite for Mac and iOS and Apple TVs and really any Apple product, and Jamp Software at jampsoftware.com. Thanks to Jamp for sponsoring Out of School this week.
Okay, so I think we should put on our adult diapers and get ready for this rather long topic that we have tonight, which is configuration profiles. And configuration profiles are, they are both an art and a science, I think it's fair to say. There's art to the way you structure it, there's frankly politics in the way that you deploy them, and there's a lot of sort of technical details that go along with how to get the best out of configuration profiles as well. Is that a fair summary of the situation?
Yeah.
It is art and science, absolutely. But first of all, Bradley, let's talk about what are configuration profiles. So for people who are new to administering iOS, configuration profiles go back to the beginning of iOS. And we talked in earlier shows about iPhone Configuration Utility, which was a precursor to Apple Configurator, which was a precursor to all the MDM interfaces that we work with today. And you can think about a configuration profile as a set of settings that you can apply to an iOS device just by installing the file. So if I was to email you a configuration profile and you were to double tap it or tap it in Mail and install it, you would get whatever settings were set in that configuration profile applied to your iPad. If you want to see, if you have any on your device, you can find them in the Settings app in the General section in Profiles. And that section doesn't appear if you don't have any profiles installed in your device. And inside a profile, you have one or more what are called payloads of, and those are specific settings for specific areas of iOS. And we're going to talk about a range of those kind of payloads today. Mostly we're going to talk about the restrictions profile and the security settings in the general profile. The restrictions payload and the general payload. There are many more to do with things like VPN and AirPlay and printing and SCEP and things like that. But we're going to mostly focus tonight on Wi-Fi, the general settings and the restrictions payload, and I'll talk a little bit about the email payload as well later on.
And the reason we're kind of focusing on those is because those are the ones we found that most schools spend most time on. Yep. The other ones, like if you've got a specific reason to be setting up a VPN profile, you probably already understand that payload.
Yeah, the once you get beyond restrictions are the kind of things that most people would want to do. Deploying email is something that you might want to start doing once you scale up a little bit. And I've got a couple of tips and tricks. If you do use a MDM server like Jamf, there's some cool stuff you can do in there. Other MDMs may support the same thing. But really and truly, what we're talking about here is the restriction settings are the ones that you'll use to sort of constrain behavior on your iOS devices in ways that you might want. And what we'll try and do when we get through that as well is talk about what settings are available, but also why you might want to use them in a school setting. Because quite often what happens is when people come to iOS, particularly systems administrators come to iOS, their first question is, how many things can be locked down? And I want to try and articulate a philosophy of not trying to lock down everything straight away, and using configuration profiles partly also as a sanction against bad behavior rather than as an absolute barrier to stopping any of it happening in the first place.
So how do you, like if you have these profiles, here's how you deploy them. There's really multiple ways. You can push them out via your mobile device manager system, so Casper, AirWatch, Smaz 360, Meraki, any of those. Those go out over the air. So you're at, you know, whatever place you're making this profile, your phone, your iPad, your laptop, you know, across the world, and you can just push it out. And when the phone checks into the MDM, it will download it. And this is pretty amazing when you watch it happen. Like I was last week was revoking a certificate I had put on, like it was or changing a restriction. And it's amazing to watch that like just like start to happen. I mean, you just refreshing the page, and it's like, you know, it's completed this many, you know, devices. So it's really quite amazing. You can install them from websites using the Safari browser. And of course, there you kind of do need to be careful about what you are installing, of course. You can install them over email using Apple Mail. And if you can sideload them using Apple Configurator. So if you're wanting to, you know, where you might want to do this is if you decided to run your devices through Configurator, you could like preload a Wi-Fi profile, for example, before you ever even basically set them up.
Yeah, for example, if you're trying to set up these devices and you don't have control over the Wi-Fi and you need to have a key put into the devices before you can enroll them, that might be the way you do that, plug them into Configurator. That method of use is mostly going away with device enrollment because assuming you can get some kind of Wi-Fi network up and running that may be completely open for the purposes of registration, then doing device enrollment and pushing all your configuration profiles out over MDM is actually probably the best way. It's quite unlikely that in a school situation you'll be using installing profiles from websites or installing them via email because that kind of requires the end user to take some action in order to get the profiles on the device, which you probably don't want to rely on for school kids. That's more a kind of enterprise thing where you might email something to all your sales staff and they install this profile and they suddenly got like new links to documents or something appearing as clips on their home screen or something like that. And I would strongly encourage you not to train people to install configuration profiles from websites because, as we'll talk about later, that actually is a vector for installing pirated apps. And there are controls that you can use to prevent people from doing that as well. So really and truly, for the school situation, pushing them over MDM or installing them via Apple Configurator if you're not using device enrollment or if there are some other reasons why you need to have something on the device before it's enrolled in MDM.
Yeah, it's so just, you know, in fact, I know there's a reason that I installed them like via Safari and Mail, but like that is just in some ways a tough place to be in.
Yeah, it's something, if your users are adults, you might be able to rely on that. But it's probably there for convenience as much as anything else. But that is, of course, how you enroll in the public beta program for iOS, is you go to an Apple website, you sign in, and you download a configuration profile and install it from the web. And that's how you put your iOS devices onto the public beta track for the next version of iOS.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's new for this go-around, too.
Yes, for iOS it is, yeah. Yep, yep.
One of those. So we'll finally get somewhere in doing things not without a computer for the betas.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. That's another step towards, you know, an iOS-only lifestyle is you don't even need a computer to get onto preview versions of iOS now, which you previously did in all earlier times.
Okay, so let's walk through how a profile is structured.
Okay, so a configuration profile, it's not exactly an XML document. It's what Apple calls a property list file, which is Apple's particular dialect of XML or style sheet, if you like. And basically what it is, it's combinations of keys and values, like in programming, like a dictionary or an associative array. And what you have in there is you have multiple payloads, and there's one payload that is required for any configuration profile, which is called the general settings payload. And in there, that's just kind of administrative information about your profile. Things like, what's the name of the profile? What's the name of the organization installing it? There's a field for what's called the consent message, which is text that can be displayed to the user before the profile is installed. So you might use that, for example, to explain the purpose of this profile. That's not so important if you're pushing profiles over MDM. It's optional. But if you were sending them by email, for example, it might be helpful to put some explanatory text in there to encourage people to install it or to be careful about it. Most importantly, in the general settings, though, there's a section about security settings for removal. And this is a place where you can really go quite badly wrong. And I'm speaking from long ago now, but personal experience at the time, which is that you can control when the user can take this profile off their device. And there's three options. One is called always, which means that the user just has to tap a button and they can delete that profile from their device. The second one is never, and never really means never. You have to restore the device to get rid of that profile. And the final one is called with authorization, which is then you get a password dialog or a password field, and you can type in a password that you would have to enter on the device to get rid of that profile. And I would recommend if you are deploying these profiles over Configurator or something like that, to use with authorization, because there will eventually arise a time when you need to, for whatever edge case reason, have to take a profile off a device. And being able to do that without having to reset the device is very, very helpful. And then there's two other options, or one other option with two different settings, for automatic profile removal. And you can set it to for the profile to basically self-destruct after a certain number of days or on a specific date. And one way that you could use this in schools is for sort of doing a kind of disciplinary sin bin situation, where you could create a, let's say, for example, the classic case that somebody's misbehaving with their device camera. You could create a profile that would automatically delete itself after 7 days. You put it on the device, so you don't have to remember after 7 days to go and find that pupil and take the profile off. You can just have confidence that when you install that, 7 days will pass and then the profile will automatically take itself off the device. So that's quite a useful way to use that setting in a school situation.
Yeah, or you could even say, is there any limit on how far in advance you could do the dates?
I'm not sure. No, I don't know. I think it's just a text field, and you get to type in whatever date you want.
Yeah, you could even do something like let this expire in last day of school, for example.
Yeah. So if, for example, you have students who are leaving school in the summer, or if you're in a bring your own device situation, you could say, well, we need this profile on until the end of the school year, and then we can have it expire. So without any actual work on your part, you can just make that.
Yeah, and so one of the neat things, like I know that a lot of Wi-Fi networks can do, like ours can do, is you can force. So let's say you had someone that like the profile was installed via NVM and it wasn't installed via the device interrupt program, so it was like a BYOD, and then they get cute on the weekends and remove the profile and remove the device from MDM. Well, in a lot of Wi-Fi networks, you can basically force the enrollment of MDM in order to actually get on the Wi-Fi. So there's like kind of one way to force that. Yeah, even if they get queued on the weekends, when they come back to school on Monday, they'll have to re-enroll into the MDM and they'll have to take that configuration payload again.
Yeah, there are a number of Wi-Fi networks that can talk to certain MDMs. And when a device tries to associate with the network for the first time, it will check with the MDM, hey, do you know this serial number or this MAC address? And if the MDM says yes, the device gets on the network, and if it says no, it doesn't. And that was basically the technique that was used until device enrollment came out to force people to either keep or reapply their MDM profiles. Whereas now with device enrollment, if you have a device that's created through DEP, you can actually, in the enrollment for DEP, you can say, require the user to put the MDM profile on, and then secondly, prevent them from ever taking it off. So you can actually force at the device level that the MDM profile never comes off. Because one of the things about profiles is that if you have a profile from your device management server, all the profiles that came from your MDM server, as a result of that profile being installed, they will all disappear as well if the device is unenrolled from MDM. So if you enroll a device, get the MDM profile in, and then you set in email settings and restrictions and a Wi-Fi network, if the user takes the MDM profile off, all those other settings will go away as well. So it can sometimes be quite complex and quite a big deal for people to take the MDM certificate off. It's not a good idea.
Yeah, it's not just like wanting to take control of the device. It could affect just how the device is structured.
Yeah, and you could end up in a situation where some apps could be removed as well, like managed apps could be taken off if the device is unenrolled.
Hey, it's probably a good place to mention the Twitter conversation that we had.
It was pointed out to us that, from we were talking in the last show about device-assigned apps, the problem, or one of the limitations with that, is that the data created by those apps will not be backed up into an iCloud backup. Now, if you deployed Keynote or Pages that way, an app that uses documents and data sync in iCloud, those documents would still be stored in iCloud. But it would not be stored as part of the iCloud backup. So that's something to be aware of if you are thinking about deploying managed device-assigned managed apps as opposed to user-assigned.
Yeah, because if you restored that device, you'd have to then reassign the apps. So just to clarify, if it's like an app that has local data that's not synced anywhere, mm-hmm. it is not included in the backup. Yes. But if it has data that is synced with iCloud, and not just backed up, but synced with iCloud, so again, like a Keynote, you know, saved in iCloud Drive, or just you know, synced with iCloud, that would be fine.
Yes. The app could be reassigned and the data would still be in iCloud to be reconnected with the app.
Yeah, so an easy way to think about this is if you can install this app on another device and get access to your data, then that app is fine.
That's something definitely to be aware of. I there's also the question of whether the app supports device assignment as well. So a little bit of auditing work might be important there. But apps, it seems to me that apps are sort of quite quickly moving towards having some kind of iCloud sync or some other form of sync as well, or iCloud Drive support, because it's becoming quite robust. For example, Ulysses, an app I mentioned earlier on, it can actually sync its entire database through iCloud as well. It's quite cool. So back to configuration profiles. One last thing to say, that we talked about the general settings payload, and then after general, you can have one or more additional payloads in the configuration profile. Some payloads may appear more than once. Okay, so for example, if you wanted to set up several email accounts on a device, you could have multiple email payloads in one profile and they would all appear on the device at the same time. Other payloads only appear once, such as the restrictions payload. It just has its set of settings and it just gets installed on the device. So that's the basic structure, is multiple sections, and some of those sections can appear more than once. VPN is another one that allows you to appear more than once. Calendar settings, Wi-Fi, anything that's kind of account-based, there tends to be options to put multiple payloads into one profile.
Yeah, you can see where like these can be a rabbit hole.
Oh yes, you can get down to a very fine level of control with configuration profiles. And I think probably before we go into talking about restrictions payload, I think one of the key things to think about here is not to overthink it, because you can go crazy with this. And the second thing I would recommend is not to have too many different sets for different groups in the school, if you can avoid it. Just to kind of give you a concrete example of that, we have, because our devices are not in DEP at the moment, we have one profile, which we call the base profile, that goes onto every device through Apple Configurator. And then all the rest of our profiles go on through MDM enrollment. But we have about 13 profiles, and I'll explain why we have 13 later on. But almost every iPad in the school gets the same 13. There's only one consistent exception, which is that the 5 and 6 year olds don't have to have a passcode on their devices. But in all the rest of the years, primary 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, S1 to 6, all of the devices in the school should have the same 13 profiles on them. And I'll explain later why it's as many as it is, but I try not to create too many different groups because it just becomes very confusing to administer if you do it that way.
Yeah, I'll second that. Leave it at that. You can get in a situation where you can't figure out why something's not working, and then it's like you're having to keep moving stuff in and moving devices in and out to see, you know, so it's, you know, it's not working. One of the things that always trips me up on a lot of this is like app that needs a location. Mm-hmm. Do you know how you can block and unblock the allowing apps to access location data on a device?
Do you mean from configuration?
Yeah.
I can't bring that to mind.
Allow user to modify Find My Friend settings.
Huh.
I mean, why that makes sense.
Yeah. There are some restrictions that their name does not quite give you all of the implications of setting up those things. And sometimes the thing that kind of maddens me about configuration profiles is that with different updates for iOS, the behavior of the key changes. So one of the things that happened, I think, between iOS 7 and 8 was that if you had any kind of age restriction, this was not true in iOS 7 and it became true in iOS 8, I believe. If you had any kind of App Store age restriction on the device, then you had to put in the Apple ID password to re-download any previously purchased app. That was not true before, and that kind of has been an annoyance in our deployment over the past little while, is that even to update an app, you need to put in a password as well, because you know the content might change or whatever. And that was a change in the behavior of the App Store in some version of iOS. Despite us having the same configuration profile for 3 years on the device, the implications of those settings started to change over time, which was kind of annoying and quite difficult.
Yeah, confusing. And it's like, I remember this happened last year. We have like our auction, our like a school fundraiser, I mentioned that. We, to accept payments and things, we'll load up the Square app on a handful of iPads. That it's like they never, and the Square app requires location. I never could figure it out. It took me literally 30 minutes to figure it out that the Find My Friends section is what controls the ability to do that. And that makes zero sense. Huh. But
yeah, that needs a better name, doesn't it?
Or just allow modifying location.
Yeah, you have that for other things. So let's talk, Bradley, about the restrictions payload, because that's kind of where the action is for schools, really and truly. And really what this is about is it's about a lot of control, okay? You get to do things to iOS devices here that, it's a little bit surprising that Apple lets us do some of these things. But you can have very tight control over both hardware and software features here. And if you deploy them right, you can really lock these things out and make it very difficult for people to get to them. First thing to say, though, is that some of these restrictions require that the device is supervised. Now, we've talked about supervision before in the rollout section. Supervision is this claim that you can make on a device to say it's managed by the organization. Supervision doesn't actually, the name is, I think, a bit of a poor choice, because it doesn't actually imply that you're sort of spying on the device or you're gathering data from it. It just means that an organization has deployed this device. They have placed they've made additional claims on the controls for the device. And if you are supervised, you get to do some things to the device that you wouldn't get to do if it was, say, a bring your own device situation where the device belonged to someone else and the school hadn't supervised it first. Supervision is a step you do basically the day you get it out of the box. You can actually do over the air with the device enrollment program, or you can do it using a USB cable with Apple Configurator. But whenever you supervise a device, it completely erases the device. And that's why it's rare to see that done in a bring your own device situation, because nobody wants you to erase their iPad on the first day of school. And this is why one of the reasons why I'm quite strongly in favor of institutional deployments rather than BYOD.
Yeah, it's just not feasible to like wipe all those iPads day one. I mean,
although some schools are actually claiming that right. I mean, there was an article I saw from an Australian school where they were asking parents to go and buy an iPad and then bring it into school and have it wiped by the techs and then set up as if it was a school-owned iPad. And it's like, how? Where do you get off asking people to do that?
At that point, it's just like, you know? Give them a fee for the iPad on their student account and just buy it for them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's all kinds of politics around asking people for money in schools and so in some countries. But it's... I'm surprised anybody gets away with that. Let's just leave it at that. So having said that about restrictions, here are some of the things that you can just simply turn off, right? I'm just going to read this list and then we'll talk about reasons to choose some of them later. You can turn off, the camera. You can disable taking a screenshot. You can disable FaceTime and iMessage, voice dialing, Siri, iCloud backup, iCloud photo library, iCloud photo sharing, iCloud Keychain, Handoff, the predictive keyboard, spell check, autocorrect, keyboard shortcuts, definition lookup in text fields. You can disable the ability to use erase all content and settings, the ability to change the device name. You can disable trusting new enterprise app authors, and you can disable installing new configuration profiles, disable modifying the passcode, disable modifying the wallpaper, disable modifying any of the on-device restrictions. And you can do things like disable Touch ID. So that's just some of them. There are plenty more as well, but these are the ones I thought I would kind of highlight as being things you can turn off.
And this is a list that I know a lot of schools are interested in controlling.
Yep. A couple of reasons why you might want to do some of these. FaceTime and iMessage, just for like disruption in the classroom, quite frankly. We've turned those off ever since it was possible for us to turn them off, and I haven't really had a reason to regret doing that so far. Turning off the camera, I think, is more of a sanction rather than something you would preemptively do, because the camera is so useful in school, right? You know, one of the big reasons why iOS devices are as good as they are in the classroom is because of the camera. But there's no doubt that some people might abuse it, and having the ability to turn the camera off is actually quite a useful thing to keep in your back pocket if you need it.
I would like to see some of these restrictions become location-based, to where you could say, okay, block iMessage and FaceTime at this geofence.
Yeah, some MDMs do provide that kind of feature, but it's not. And, you know, Casper and some others can even use iBeacons for very narrow geofencing, but it's not something I've seen widely deployed so far. A lot of schools want the ability to do things like hide apps when they come into school and then release those when they go out of school. That's more of something that BYOD schools want to do, but at the moment that's not possible. A number of these are also to do with things like using an iPad in exams. So all the keyboard and spell checking settings and so on, those are the kind of things that you're often required to turn off if you're going to do a test on the iPad, for example. A couple of other things to mention. The one about trusting new enterprise app authors and installing new configuration profiles. This is a way that people had used to install like pirated iOS apps on devices, is that you can go to some sketchy websites and you can basically download a configuration profile that would then install an app that was signed by some kind of enterprise key, for example. And disabling the ability to install new configuration profiles is a defense against that. We had a situation a year or so ago where some kids had done that to get certain games and stuff on their devices, which we didn't want to have there, so we had to clear off those devices and reset them. But then bringing that setting on gives us some protection against people doing that in the future. Things about modifying passcode and modifying wallpaper and restrictions. Those are maybe more for shared device situations. So one of the things that I've seen people do in the past is like students will actually go and turn on certain restrictions. In the settings app, you go to settings, restrictions, and turn it on. And a student would turn that on and then forget the PIN code and something's been disabled on the device that can't be undisabled. So if you disable modifying restrictions, it means that students can't actually add additional restrictions to devices as well, which is useful in a shared situation.
Yeah, and the wallpaper is, I think, fairly new.
I think that's an iOS 9 setting, possibly even a 9.1 setting, maybe. This is one of the few areas in iOS where new features come out in point releases, that sometimes new restrictions come along every so often when people really need them. There is actually a document that describes the behavior of all of these keys available on the Apple website as well. There's also restrictions that are to do with what are called managed versus unmanaged destinations. Now, I've referred to managed apps already tonight. A managed app is an app, basically an app that's installed by an MDM server. But this is Apple's way. You know how like some sort of secure smartphones, like some of the Samsung phones, have basically got a dual personality? I don't know if you've seen those, Bradley, where you kind of either log in as your personal user or as your corporate user, and the whole phone experience just switches between the two things. And it's kind of like the screen flips around or something, and suddenly you're in the secure enterprise mode, and then you're in the personal mode after that. Apple doesn't do that. And what they do is instead they allow managed apps and unmanaged apps to coexist side by side. But there is the ability to prevent data from managed apps being transferred into unmanaged apps. So, for example, if we store all our school documents in Google Drive, I could install Google Drive as a managed app, say on a staff member's iPad, that may be their personal iPad. And then I could also say, don't allow somebody to use OpenIn to send a document from a managed app, such as our school Google Drive system, to an unmanaged app, like, for example, this teacher's personal Dropbox account, for example. So a lot of that's to do with information security, really, rather than user control.
Yeah, and in certain, you know, like you said, in certain situations, those are going to be... This is a feature that's definitely appealing to the enterprise crowd and the security-conscious crowd.
Yeah, it's something that's nice to have. You know, if you're putting iPhones into banks, for example, or legal companies, you would really want to have those features on. And I suppose for schools as well, for some kinds of data, depending on where it is and what you've got. You can also do things like prevent managed apps sending data out through AirDrop. That was possible in iOS 7, I think. You had all this managed versus unmanaged security, but then you could just AirDrop the app out, AirDrop the file out to anywhere, and you didn't know where that was going. There's a number of restrictions related to lock screen information as well. What gets seen on the lock screen, for example, you can control access to notification center, control center, and so on from the lock screen, which we normally have enabled, but you can actually disable that stuff for security if you need to. So what do you think the key ones are, Bradley?
I mean, we'll never FaceTime and iMessage. Touch ID could be big. I can just see kids like messing around with other kids. Device name, because that does show up on the Wi-Fi network as well.
Yes, on the Wi-Fi network and in AirDrop.
So, like, you know, there, you could think of ways that students could either be vulgar or could kind of like impersonate another kid, for example, like on the Wi-Fi network. Obviously, yep. You could deduce it back with like a MAC address type, you know, lookup and things like that. But just, you know, from first glance, I think the device name for big for me, and the Touch ID. I think those are some those again. Obviously, FaceTime, iMessage, all that.
Yeah. So in a recent version of iOS, MDM servers gained the ability to set the device name remotely, and some of them will enforce that. So whenever a device checks in with a different name, they will set it back to the name that you specified in the MDM. But in iOS 9, it's possible actually to set up a setting that says the user may not ever change the device name. So in the previous situation, what you could do is you could set, you could say, you know, as an MDM server, I set the device name. And then until the next check-in, which is typically 24 hours, the user could change the device name again back, and they get 24 hours of bad behavior before your MDM server reset the name to what it's supposed to be. But under iOS 9, you can actually say, don't let the user ever change this name, so they can't even activate the edit field for the device name. And your point about impersonation is right, Bradley, because I've seen this happen in school where kids will change their device name to something that is like maybe four emojis or something like that. And then they'll, from with that anonymity, they'll start to pester other people via AirDrop by airdropping them files or pictures or whatever that they shouldn't be doing. So being able to do that, being able to force a device name, at least it makes it come up and say, you know, person X is trying to share, so that the person who's being airdropped to could actually know who was doing it and report it to the teacher if they wanted to.
Yeah, it's fun. Those were, it's like fun to think about like how this stuff impacts in like actual classroom things and, you know, kids getting in trouble.
Yeah, and one way you might react to that as well, let's just shut off AirDrop completely. But AirDrop's so useful that you don't want to do that. So being able to just enforce the device name removes the security of anonymity from the user, so that they have to at least have their name displayed to everybody else. And also just when you're the teacher and you're trying to AirDrop to everybody, it's very helpful to be able to see everybody's name on your screen rather than either serial numbers or device codes or whatever you set up in the first instance, or random emoji-based names as well for their devices. So, yep. Other kinds of payloads you might want to use Wi-Fi. This is what I've got. This is my little trick for Jamfusers. Setting a Wi-Fi payload is a very useful way to avoid disclosing a Wi-Fi network key if you have one. If it's a shared key, then if you roll out a configuration profile, then you don't have to ever tell anybody what the key is. You just encode it in the configuration profile, install that, and then devices will come up on the network straight away. Tricky question though is, how do you get it there? So a bit of a chicken and egg problem, unless you can throw up a registration Wi-Fi network where you can do your device enrollment step, and then your MDM server will deliver the password for the actual Wi-Fi network. That's kind of, I think that's my preferred way. I think, Bradley, it's your preferred way as well of trying to set up devices, is to be able to put up another SSID just for registration day.
Yeah, the only other way would be to like install it, that the payload via configurator. But wouldn't recommend it. And yeah, this is like, I have people ask me a lot about, like, you know, pre-shared key versus like a dynamic pre-shared key. I know like Arrowhive mm-hmm. has this. Ruck, I think Ruckus Wireless has this. And obviously, it's going to be very difficult to deploy a dynamic pre-shared key on this kind of payload because they're going to be different. You know, one of the things I remember you ran into a few years ago with PPSK with Arrowhive was the iCloud keychain sharing was sharing the key around all their devices. And
yes,
one of the things, the features of that is that you can like limit a device or a key to number, like you say, you can have one device on this key or two. And so like a student, if you have it with one, a student brings their phone in, it may connect before the iPad does.
Yeah, it was very much dependent. Like some days it would work, some days it wouldn't. And it was just it was really a race condition as to which one the user touched first when they came into the range of the network. If they walk in with their phone open, their phone's going to associate first. But if their phone's in their bag and then they bring out their iPad first, the iPad will associate and it will work correctly. And then the phone won't work. But either way, it gets confusing and tricky.
So... Once you've got all your restrictions designed and how do you want it, how do you actually build it in like your MDM or in Configurator?
Well, this is where the art comes in. We've done the science. This is the art part. And there is a thing that when it comes to restrictions payloads, you can put multiple profiles on a device. Each profile can have one restrictions payload. So the question is, what happens when two profiles are present, both with a restrictions payload, and they have conflicting values for one setting? So let's say, for example, you had two profiles, one which had a restrictions payload that said disable the camera, and one which had a payload that said enable the camera. Does the camera work or not? Well, the answer is that on iOS, you have a rule that says most restrictive wins. So if you have 15 profiles that all say the camera should be enabled and one that says the camera should be disabled, the camera will be disabled. So this is where I think is a really nice way to work with profiles is to, if you want to have, say, multiple restrictions on a device, create one profile for every restriction you want to apply. And this is why I have 13 things set, 13 different profiles on our devices, because I have one profile that just says disable iMessage, one profile that says disable FaceTime, one profile that says disable changing the device name, one profile that says disable the camera, which I don't scope to everybody straight away, but I can put individuals into that group if I need to. And everything else that I want to control, I control each with one configuration profile. So that it's really easy for me to see when I look at a device and I wonder why something's not working, I can look in settings and I can see, okay, this one has the require a passcode profile. It has the calendar, the school calendar subscription profile. It has the camera profile. Okay, well, that's why the camera's not working, is because this device has got the camera profile and it shouldn't have. So I can then go into the MDM and fix that. And I think this is something I would really encourage people to think about, is it's easier to know what's being applied. It's also easier to layer specific restrictions on and off. So in Casper and in other MDMs, you can say, well, this profile goes to all iPads in the entire school, but you can also put in an exclusions list that says except these ones. So that's how I work with my profile that requires everybody to have a passcode on their device. As I say, this one goes to every leased iPad on my MDM server, except for the ones in the primary one group and except for the ones in the primary two group. And they go in as exclusions to the list rather than anything else that you could possibly do. And it makes it much easier to create exceptions to one restriction. I have another class where they need to have a 17 plus app installed. So they are excluded from the 17 plus restriction. So things like that are possible and doable. And I really like to work that way. In earlier days, what I would have done is I said, here's the great Cedars profile that has every setting I want. And even though most of my settings are consistent across all the devices in school, it makes it much easier if you have to create an exception to policy for one reason or another, just to do that with the exclusion from one particular profile, rather than having to take everything off and put everything back on again.
Great.
I told you I was going to tell you a trick for deploying email settings through MDMs. Some MDMs, like Casper, like others, can talk to, for example, an LDAP server or an Active Directory server to bring in users for your institution. Those users can have names, departments, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, and they can all be extracted from LDAP. what you can do in some MDMs is when you create a Wi-Fi payload, you can instead of typing in the user's name and their email address and all their stuff, what you can do is you can put in placeholders for their name and a placeholder for their email address. So the way this works in Casper, and I'll talk about Casper because it's the one I know, when you have a device enrolled, you can have a user in Casper as well, and then you can connect a device and a user together by editing its owner settings in Casper. So you then have a device enrolled and you know who has that device. You can then create an email payload that says, this email account, you can put in the IMAP server and all the ports and everything, but you leave the display name and the email address as $username and $email address and leave the password blank. And what happens is when that profile is vended to a specific device, what happens is Casper goes and looks at, well, who's the user for this device, pulls out their name and their email address, sticks it into the profile before it sends it to the device. Now, this has a huge advantage in that you don't have to create one profile in your MDM server per user. You can just create one profile and it's customized for each user as it's sent out to them. And that's a massive time saver. And I wish I'd known about it quite a long time ago, but I just discovered it this year. We're definitely going to roll it out next year.
Yeah, I mean, anything you can do to, again, allow you to scale that up. That's probably a trick that if you've got, it's a nice thing for you. Mm-hmm. If you've got 5,000 devices, it's a, I've got to have this.
Absolutely, yep. And the other thing about it is that the profile doesn't contain the password. So when the mail app can get to a stage where it's kind of partially set up, but it still needs to get the password, and it can prompt the user to type in their password for that account themselves. So that the profile is not secret information in the profile. It's just the custom username for that person and their email address, but not their password. And then the user types in the password once the profile gets installed by itself.
So, you know, one of the ways this could be tricky for your like staff members is when you add a Google account and email, it does a web UI in iOS 9. And this allows it to work easily with two-factor authentication. And so I imagine this payload would not work with that.
You know when you have an email account set up on iOS and then you change your password and it comes up and says, oh, your password doesn't work anymore. Can you please re-enter your password? It's basically that flow where you go into the settings app and you're taken into the mail contacts and calendars section and you have to re-enter your password there. So the email account's already set up. But it doesn't show you like the first run settings like it would normally when you're trying to set up a Google account on iOS.
So I wonder if on Google if it would bring you to like a Google login screen.
You're talking about first setup on an account that already has two-factor authentication enabled.
Yeah. So like let's say you require your staff members to have two-factor authentication. Hand them iPads with this payload on there. Does the change password screen, is it the iOS one or is it the one from Google that has the two-factor? Because on initial setup, it's the web interface that supports two-factor.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're asking. I was thinking about our student experience because our students don't have two-factor set up because they don't have smartphones or they don't all have smartphones. I don't know the answer to that. I'll have to look at that. Yeah. Shall we wrap this up by talking about enforcing MDM?
Yes. We have a lot of... three-letter acronyms in the iOS world.
Yes, we do. Enforcing the enrollment of your device in the mobile device management server using device enrollment. Do you want to talk us through what the problems have been, Bradley, and how those get fixed?
Yeah, so I think back to, I always like judge everything based on the LAUSD thing. So prior to DEP, enforcing MDM was always a... thing you could do like at the network level, and that was really your only way to force it, because there was no way to pre-install it, but it was easily removed. And so it's not the getting installed that was the hard part, it was keeping it installed. And yes, because of the somewhat still mindset of the, it's a personal owned device, and so it's kind of like personal, there's no way to really take it over, you could always remove it. And that's really where a lot of early deployments kind of struggled with MDM, because you could have all these settings and like there was nothing to keep the kids from removing them. It was a screen door, essentially. It was keeping the honest kids honest. So, even if you set the profile to never remove, that is ignored on these like kind of big MDM profiles. Now, under MDM, or under device enrollment program, which again has these has to be institutionally purchased iPads. BYODs cannot be enrolled in DEP. MDM is a part of that setup. So when the devices go and, like, when you know, when you turn an iPad on or an, you know, any sort of iOS device, it gets on the network and it activates with Apple. That's how it's like testing. It's testing the activation lock and things like that. MDM is part of that setup. So like with Apple, you connect your MDM server to your device enrollment program login. And so there's like some sort of way they're talking back and forth. So when it actually activates with Apple, part of that activation is downloading the profile. And so you require that they take the profile, and you can require that it's non-removable. So again, the only way to do this is institutionally purchased iPads enrolled in the device enrollment program. This is probably the fundamental reason I don't recommend BYOD for a iPad deployment anymore. I mean, I had philosophical reasons before. I mean, now I just have technical reasons.
Apple have sort of historically been concerned that systems administrators would unscrupulously take over people's devices if they brought them into schools or workplaces. And I think, you know, the story I told you about schools having people buy iPads and then bring them in and wiping them and supervising them kind of bears out the paranoia that Apple's had in this area. And, you know, for those of us who have sort of somewhat better intentions in that area, it has often seemed like Apple's been unnecessarily obstructive about this. But I think in reality, if you go out into the world, you'll see that there are situations where people are maliciously, is putting it too strongly, but overstepping their bounds in terms of trying to take control of users' devices that the users themselves own. So device enrollment requires that you institutionally purchase a device. It's supervised. They talk about a chain of custody from the Apple factory to the school before they'll let you use device enrollment with it. And I think it seems fair, you know, but nowadays you're right, Bradley, that the number of configuration options and restrictions and things and just general setup you can do on a supervised device is far exceeding what you can do on an unsupervised device. And not only that, but most of the new deep configuration settings that are coming out in newer versions of iOS require the device be supervised. And in fact, what we're going to see, I believe Apple has announced this for probably a later version of iOS, is that some settings, some restrictions that were previously available for unsupervised devices are going to become supervised only. So one of these that I can remember off the top of my head is the ability to turn off Safari is going to become a supervised only setting. But those were settings that existed before supervision existed, so they've kind of been allowed to keep going for a while. But eventually some of those things that schools might depend on are actually, they're going to become supervised only settings as well.
Yeah, so go institutionally owned, go team.
Big fans of that. Yep, I mean, there's a reason I did it, right? Not just because I could, but it was very important to me that we rolled it out in a way that was controlled and managed. And particularly, you know, when you're going to be the first people in the world to do it, you don't want to be in a situation where you do it wrong. Unfortunately, we've not been. It has actually worked out very well for us over the years. So Bradley, just one thing I want to say before we wrap up on this is to make people aware that what we've talked about tonight is configuration options that are available in the currently released version of iOS as we record this, which is iOS 9.2.1. Obviously, with the stuff that's been announced in iOS 9.3, there actually is a wide range of new configuration options that are going to come out. Some of them are things we've been asking for and waiting for literally years and years and years. And I'm really excited about some of them. And I think once iOS 9.3 ships, we can have another show where we talk about the 9.3 specific configuration profile settings as well, if that sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Okay.
And one other thing to mention, we will not have a show next week. We both have some traveling obligations that are kind of going to make it difficult to record. So we've had a good run this year and have not taken a week off all year. So we're going to take a week off. So it allows anybody to catch up on the series or just have a week to listen to more music. Or what's another podcast they should listen to? Oh, I know. Canvas.
Yeah, I'm not getting a week off next week. You are.
Yeah, that's true. I am. Yeah, you're just getting a week off from one of your shows. Yeah, so if the week that we're off, if you want a show to listen to, go to Relay.fm and listen to Canvas with our good friend Fraser Spears and Federico Vitici. And so what's the can you say the next topic yet, or is that still under wraps?
So let me think. This show will be out before we record the next one, but we're planning to make it about managing PDFs on iOS. So creating them and how do you manage them and so on as well.
So yeah, go check it out at relay.fm/canvas.
One last plug for future shows. We're going to have, Apple have announced today, the day we're recording, that there's going to be an event on the 21st of March. So if you are one of our Patreon supporters, we're going to have one of our quick reaction shows. We did this for the last Apple event, and we're going to have it for this one as well. That'll be up on Patreon within a couple of hours of us finishing the recording after the event, and then it'll be out for everybody in the feed later on in the week. But if you want to get early access to that show, you can sign up at patreon.com/outofschool, and you'll get access to that show first.